Good evening. Actually, it's good afternoon because I'm in New York today, so it's actually afternoon. So good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today we have two guests. Our first guest is Haruna. Haruna is a medical doctor specializing in psychiatry, which I'm sure is useful for Nigerian politics. Our second guest is Henry. Henry is an accountant. Now, we're going to be discussing three topics today. Firstly, we're going to discuss news reports that Nigeria now spends 100% of her revenue servicing her debt. Secondly, we'll discuss what they've called the Bishopsgate scandal. It was alleged that during the unveiling of Shettima as Bola Tinubu's candidate, that bishops, some claim they were fake bishops, were present at the venue. Thirdly, we'll discuss Atiku Abubakar, who is the PDP's presidential candidate. We'll discuss his recorded interview and the contents of the discussion. So firstly to Phoenix, or first of all, let me add, there might be another guest joining us, Tosin, who is an APC supporter, a supporter of Bola Tinubu. He might be joining us on the podcast. So if you hear a fifth strange voice, just know Tosin has joined us. But anyway, to Phoenix. Phoenix, on the first topic, they said we're now spending at least 100% of Nigeria's revenues on servicing her debt. First of all, is this true? And how, secondly, how did we get here, Phoenix?
Hi, Michael. And hi, Henry and Haruna. Thanks for joining us this week. Hello, listeners. We've seen that Michael has been on a, I don't want to say globetrotting because it's only been in the US, but a US trotting tour. And of course, somebody was just saying recently that all the man is showing us is food. So hopefully he comes back with his waistline still intact. But good to be back on the podcast this week. To your first question, well, it is not true to the extent that you got the percentage wrong. As of the first 4 months of this year, from what was just released by the 2023 to 2025 NTEF document, it's actually 118%. So actually quite much worse than you had earlier alluded to. Nigeria is essentially, Nigeria in the first 4 months of this year spent 1.9 trillion naira on debt service. In the same period, we earned 1.6 trillion. So that shows that we are actually now borrowing to pay debt, to service debt, because also have to clarify what debt service means. Debt service means essentially that you're largely paying only interest on the debt that you carry. Depending on the arrangements that you've made, typically you tend to service debt by making some part repayment on the principal, if that's part of the arrangement, but most times you're typically only paying the interest on the loans that you're carrying. So it is quite dire. Now you ask, how did we get here? We got here by virtue of a government that has failed in all ramifications. And I think, I mean, it bears saying so that people can understand what I mean. Firstly, it is a failure to have any grasp of economic fundamentals in the sense that they came in, had no idea how the economy runs, but came in with all these highfalutin notions that they were going to be a government that was finally at the center and able to spend at will. So you saw the budget balloon. Before, the last budget before Buhari came on board was a 4.5 trillion naira budget, if I remember correctly. Because, I mean, the PDP, of course, knowing that in 2014 oil price crash and some of the things that NOI was talking about at that time had tried to be a bit more conservative. But these guys came in and immediately shot up their first budget to about 6 to 7 trillion, if I remember correctly. And by 2022, the budget they have for this year is 17 trillion naira. Now, that's not a problem in the sense that that for me is not an issue because it's still small. Because if you consider that Nigeria's GDP is in the region of 150 to 160 trillion naira, so 10% of GDP by government spending is not something to worry about. The problem is they shot up the budget, but did nothing, almost nothing, to increase revenue. So their revenues have remained largely the same as what even the people before them were earning, or even less. That's despite the fact that over the last 9 to 12 months, we've seen oil prices shoot up significantly, especially in the first 6 months of this year, given the crisis in Russia, Ukraine, and all of that. Oil prices have been above $100, but we've not been able to benefit, obviously, due to sheer incompetence, because all of the issues around vandalism, oil theft, I mean, no investment, and all of these kind of things means that even the quota that we're given by OPEC, we don't meet it. We, at the last count, I think we're around 1.4, 1.5 million barrels per day. We're supposed to be doing 1.7. So there's a clear 200,000 barrels shortfall. So we're not making enough from oil, and non-oil, which is obviously synonymous with how well the economy is doing, and we all know how well the economy has done, has not met the target. So the revenue that they make has consistently been well below their spending targets. And so, of course, budgeting is very simple. What you plan to spend versus what you plan to make, if there's a shortfall between what you plan to make and what you plan to spend, there's a deficit. And then money needs to come from somewhere if you still intend to spend. And so they've been borrowing from external sources. They made it a key point of their agenda, despite the fact that, again, the previous administrations had tried to win Nigeria off external debt to go more local. Why? Because you want to borrow your own currency. You have more control when you do that. But they chose specifically to go external. So as your naira begins to struggle, of course, you run into problems with that, especially if you're not earning as much FX as you expect to earn. And with that borrowing, we also know that they've been doing a lot of, they've been leaning heavily on CBN through the Ways and Means and all of that. And so you have a situation where the debt has been piling up. Now, again, I must say that debt of itself is not a problem. The problem is, what are you using the money for? And as we've seen over the last 7 years, we've not seen anything meaningful that they've used the money to do. You've not seen investment in areas that would unlock the economy and enable the growth in the economy to create wealth that then pays in form of taxes to the government and increase revenue such that the debt won't be a problem. So you have this vicious cycle where they've been borrowing incessantly and have not been able to scale up the revenue, creating that gap such that now we're in a place where they even need to borrow to pay to service debt. And that's where we are. And this is something that has been foretold. We've talked about this over the 7 years of this administration, that this is where we're headed to. So it's not a surprise. The next administration is obviously going to inherit this poison chalice. And that's why that choice becomes even more critical. But I'll leave it here and let the others jump in.
Thank you, Phoenix. Henry, you've heard from Phoenix. He's summarized the problem. He said it's actually 118% of revenue that is now being spent on debt repayment, which basically means we're borrowing money to repay our debts. Now, as he's also said, whoever is coming in next is going to be battling a serious financial crisis or fiscal crisis. In your view, Henry, of all the candidates, who do you think is best equipped to solve this problem? And how would you even recommend they go about solving the problem, Henry?
Okay, thank you. I hope I'm loud enough.
Yes, you are. You are loud enough.
Okay, thanks. Okay, good to be here. Phoenix has done a good job summarizing the the extent of the crisis that we are facing at this point. So he mentioned that the current debt revenue ratio is about 118%. For context, it was around 30% as at 2014, which was the last full year before this administration came into office. And due to a combination of misguided spending priorities and poor economic policies that have curtailed the growth of the private sector, we have not been able to meet the revenue growth expectations. And also spending has essentially been essentially out of control, as it were. So there are two elements to this, like Phoenix pointed out. There's revenue and there's expenditure. On revenue, we've talked about the kind of economic policies that need to be put in place to ensure that the government can generate enough from the private sector, that the government can stimulate enough investment in the oil and gas industry so that the revenues that are needed can come in. I won't spend too much time rehashing all of those things, so I'll talk a bit more about expenditure. There was, before this administration came into office, there was a panel report that by the former head of service of the Federation, I seem to remember at the time, Stephen Oronsaye chaired a committee that produced the report talking about how to reduce the level of government expenditure and the level of waste and inefficiency in government. That report gathered dust, was never implemented. Had we had an administration committed to fiscal prudence and had implemented the report at the time, eliminated the series of wasteful government agencies and departments performing multiple functions, I think would have been a much better place today. And for me, the next step from the next administration is to first return to that report and begin to see what avenues can exist to bring down the costs of government. There will be no solution to this without going back to foreign creditors and renegotiating another debt relief like it was done during the Obasanjo administration. But for that to happen, we need an administration that has a bit of credibility, that can show that we have taken certain steps to cut down on wasteful government spending. Cutting down wasteful government spending will be indispensable if we are going to try to arrive at a solution to this. Now, if we look at the respective candidates, what are they promising? Tinubu, I hardly have a sense of what his manifesto is. He's talking about recruiting 50 million youths to fight insecurity. Even China has an army that isn't more than 2 million, if I recall, and they have the world's largest standing army. So no one knows what he's talking about. Atiku gave a sense of his policy priorities in the recent Arise interview he did, which I think we'll touch on later, where he talked about the need for debt restructuring and that he's looking into a proposal on how to do that. So maybe we'll hear some more detailed ideas coming forward. Peter Obi, who, full disclosure, I'm in support of, has also been harping on this issue, and he has talked about the need for fiscal responsibility. He's talked about the need for bringing down the cost of governance. And when I look at the respective statements or manifestos that each of the candidates have produced, I think he is the one with the best, without wanting to, you know, endorse a candidate outright in this program. He is the person who has given like the best indication about the pathway to achieving this. Atiku might also be a person with the right ideas on how to do this, but he appears to have negated some of his ideas on cutting out the cost of governance with some of the promises that he has made. For example, in his security, when it comes to security, he promised he was going to hire more police officers. He also talked about certain other priorities which may lead to increased government spending. But you can't really address this problem without without a willingness to cut down on government spending, a willingness to engage in more fiscal prudence, to give the right ideas to the international community and the people who we owe so that we can negotiate a debt restructuring deal, which I think will be inevitable if you're going to come out of this crisis. Because if you're already in a situation where debt is higher than revenue, then you have to be able to show the people who you owe that there is a pathway to becoming more fiscally prudent before you can reach a debt renegotiation deal or a debt forgiveness deal even. So that's how I view this situation. We'll have to show the ability to cut down on wasteful spending that this administration has committed us into. And then we can use that as the basis to show that we are credible to the international community where we can begin to negotiate a reduction in debt.
Thank you, Henry. I need to ask you a follow-up question because you have implied that whilst OB is focused, that's Peter OB, is focused on cutting down expenditure. Atiku has indicated that he's going to increase government expenditure to hire police and security services or forces. But the question is, we do know that Nigeria is also in the midst of a security crisis. So how exactly do you think OB is going to cut spending when actually we need to increase spending on the security crisis? Because as you know, we still have people in captivity every single day. New terrorist group seems to be springing up, attacking churches, kidnapping people. So is it actually feasible to be cutting down on government spending at this time, Henry?
Well, without being a Peter Obi spokesperson, I've always felt that we can't, the insecurity challenges we are facing in Nigeria today, essentially our security forces are overwhelmed to start with. And number two, there are too many sympathizers of some of these terrorists or just some of these terrorist groups in our security forces. They are just too compromised. So I would, if I were president, I haven't heard Obi say this, but I'm speaking for myself. I would return to the Jonathan policy where he tried to get a mixture of security agencies with some foreign mercenaries. I think it will be inevitable if you are going to be able to address some of the security challenges from the roots. That's as an immediate step. Obviously, things like state police, things like more community-based security networks are also going to be very, very relevant. But one of the most important things we need to do immediately is that we need to get foreign help, we need to get foreign assistance. Our security forces are overwhelmed with dealing with the spate of challenges, security challenges all around the country. And while we work on the more or the longer term work of decentralizing our security networks and ensuring we have state and community policing, the more immediate challenge is to get foreign help. Our security forces are overwhelmed.
Thank you, Henry. Haruna, I know you're from the Northeast, so I want to ask you certain questions specific to that region. As you know, there's still a security crisis there. And then you add to the fact that there's a number of internally displaced people, refugees within our own country. And then universities are on strike. Doctors have not been paid properly or have not been paid because they claim, the government claims it doesn't have enough funds. And now we're hearing that over 100% of our revenue is being used to repay debt. So in practical terms, especially in the Northeast, but also across Nigeria, what are the implications on the people if a government is in this sort of fiscal mess? Haruna.
All right. Thank you for inviting me to the program again. That's quite, I suppose that question, I know you've sort of specified to the Northeast, but I think it's something we need to look at even in the context of the whole country, isn't it? Perhaps maybe the Northeast and maybe Northwest is peculiar in the sense of the insecurity and maybe level of poverty, but I think it's something that would affect the whole country in that sense, I'll just, to answer your question, I'll look at, for example, a state like Osun State. It is one of those states that sort of mirrors what is happening to the whole country now, where you have such a high debt profile and then very little revenue, or all the revenue goes into servicing of debt, like the other speakers have alluded to. And what that means is the money trickling down to other, I think what you would see is maybe in terms of the Northeast, where you have a lot of ongoing things like people in IDPs being fed by from the federal government pulse and things like that. I suppose some of those funds will then not become available and things like that. Will that make things worse? Definitely it will. So it's going to affect everyone in terms of the common man. And for those states where security is even the major challenge, then the little money they perhaps would be able to get from the, whatever the government is able to give them eventually, a lot of it would then go into security and, maintaining the in terms of security votes or maintaining the peace. And it would mean there will be virtually nothing left for other things, in terms of projects, development, and like I said, even the IDPs and things. So the common man is really going to suffer in those parts of the country. But I think it wouldn't be limited only to the Northeast, but it will spread elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Haruna. Let's go to our next topic, which is the what they've called on social media the Bishopsgate scandal. Now, Phoenix, can you talk us through what exactly happened? Because there are allegations and counter-allegations. So can you tell us the story of how this Bishopsgate scandal emerged, Phoenix?
Well, Michael, it's quite a funny one. So, of course, we know that Tinubu, the presidential candidate of the APC, had sort of like announced his choice of Kashim Shettima, former governor of Borno State, as his running mate. Ahead of the deadline set by INEC, and made sure that was done. But then they wanted to do a formal presentation, which was delayed a bit because, of course, there was some blowback as a result of the fact that both men are Muslims, and traditionally in Nigeria, at least since we returned to democracy in 1999, there's always been this intent to balance the ticket between the two major religions in the country. And typically when you have a Muslim presidential candidate, you would have a Christian VP candidate, blah, blah, blah. But in this instance, this was a Muslim ticket. And so there was some consternation across the land. Eventually they would do the presentation to the public. And because of all the noise that had been gathered, there had been some pushback from Christians, very Christians in the North, even within the APC party itself. I recall that some leaders within the APC who are Christians from the North had said something about not being able to support the ticket and all that. So there was that challenge from a religious perspective. And so I believe in their strategy meetings, they decided that, look, the way to counter this is to show that actually there are some senior Christian leaders that are supportive and see the value of the ticket in of itself, regardless of the religious connotation. And so they had the presentation of Shettima to the public, and we started seeing reports they call them bishops. That always makes me laugh, but I say bishops in quotes. We started hearing reports that there were clergymen, a number of clergymen at the presentation. And we started seeing videos and all of that, and very quickly became clear that there was something off about this clergyman, because there were videos showing up with them at one point some of them were even dressing up under trees or something. It was also clear that a lot of them were wearing their robes in the wrong manner. I didn't even know much about that. But I mean, I started seeing what people were calling out. But the part that really was interesting to me was not just the fact that they were there. Obviously, to add that that sheen of credibility from the Christian side of Nigeria to it. But then they were acknowledged by Shettima himself when he was giving his speech. He talked about 30 bishops and further, you know, entrenched the idea that they had some support from people of the, from senior members of the clergy of the Christian faith. Now, I say that because it's important that people bear in mind what it means to be a bishop, at least in the, in most of the denominations that we have. Bishops are super senior people. So, I mean, a bishop doesn't just show up alone. I mean, they come with other clergymen to support them. But, I mean, if we were to look at it in military parlance, a bishop would be like a general. And then you would have some, you know, colonels, captains, all those kind of things in the entourage to show how senior the person is. But obviously, from what we were seeing, these were not very senior people. These were people who were not even acknowledged on the state beyond Shettima calling out 30 bishops. They were not named. We saw some of them carrying chairs by themselves. So it was very comical. And quite frankly, it did nothing to help the ticket. Later on, of course, I think it was Tinubu or somebody in his camp who come out later and say they were, they tried to explain it in a way that they were, is he aspiring bishops or something like that? I forget what they said, but it was supposed to mean that, oh, they're not well known because they're just building their ministry, even adding more fuel to the fire. But I think for me, there were a couple of things I will call out before I hand over. It was the fact that initially they were trying to sell the idea that, look, this is about competence, this is about, you know, but they went to this lens because they understood that balance actually matters, no matter what they were trying to sell in the first place. But the second thing for me is therefore the deceitfulness in the way in which they went about it. And that, of course, shows the kind of characters that are involved in the APC in general, and particularly in this ticket. I mean, going to that extent to bring people who are not clergymen or even senior enough clergymen, you know, giving them robes and doing all of that was beyond the pale. And a lot of people have commented that, look, if this had been the other way around and had been about Islam, I'm not interested in going into all of that. But this, it just shows me and reinforces the fact that these are people of questionable character, and Nigeria shouldn't give them any hope of getting into ASUROC come 2023.
Thank you, Phoenix, for giving us the background to this Bishopsgate drama. Now let me come to Henry. Henry, a number of Christians on social media got upset and said, first of all, that what right do these people have to present themselves as bishops, and that this is an insult to the Christian faith. Is that how you perceived it? Do you think it was an insult that people dressed up as bishops? Secondly, what impact do you think this will have on the electorate? Do you think voters are now going to be persuaded to back this ticket because bishops have endorsed it? Henry?
Well, you know, the whole thing would have been so funny if it wasn't about such a serious issue. Like, if I weren't a Nigerian and I was just like observing political events in this country from afar, I'd be laughing my behind off every single day. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. And the thing about it is, the thing about APC is they do the propaganda, but they don't do it competently. There were people over there who they claimed were bishops. Some were wearing, like Phoenix said, were wearing the attires the wrong way. There was a lady who was wearing a wedding ring. Who knows about the married bishop in Nigeria? I mean, it's just so funny. To be fair, of course, there are many people who would view the issue as an insult, quite understandably, because we all know what the reaction would have been had the tables been turned. If we had a Christian ticket, and we had people pretending to be imams endorsing a Christian ticket, we know how that would have gone down. I don't need to go into details as to what would have been the consequences. They wouldn't even have dared to try it. I mean, if the APC were interested in doing actual propaganda to show that there are Christians who endorse, there are Christians in this country who supports the APC and who endorse this ticket, you should just have gotten them out to speak up. Say, I am a Christian, I believe in this ticket, and this is why. That couldn't have been difficult. Just get regular people, you can get party members, or you don't have to pretend that they are bishops. Now, what was that about? Of course, people were going to find that insulting. So I am in complete agreement with that point of view. As to your second question, I'm not really sure it will have one effect one way or the other in the election, because I think a lot of people at this point, from what I can see, a lot of people are already leaning one way or the other, and I don't think they're going to change their minds based on this. They're either going for the continuity ticket of Tinubu, or they're going for the PDP ticket, maybe a ticket of pragmatism for Atiku, or they're going for a ticket of change and a rejection of the establishment, which Peter Obi represents for many people. I think a lot of Nigerians who intend to vote next year are already leaning one way or the other. I don't think they're going to change their minds based on this. If anything, people will just double down. So I think leading up to the election, there will be other issues that will arise that might take the attention away from this. I'm not sure it's going to be on the top of voters' minds come February. But it just goes on to show why I do not believe the APC should be rewarded with another 4 years or 8 years in Aso Rock. The divisiveness and the use of religious sentiments or pandering to religious sentiments for votes is something that has been done more in the last 8 years than before. It's gotten worse. And I don't think the APC should be rewarded with it. Yeah.
Thank you, Henry. The first thing I'd say is, I'm sure there are married bishops, because Bishop Oyedepo, for example, he's a bishop, but he's married. And even Idahosa, the wife of the late Archbishop Idahosa, she's a bishop and she's married. Isn't that correct, Henry? No?
Wait, I thought these people, okay, correct me if I'm wrong. I thought they were portraying them as specifically Catholic bishops, not like bishop with the title of bishop, but like Catholic bishops.
They had
the appearance. They are supposed to have the attires of Catholic bishops, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I think some Pentecostal bishops,
like David Oyedepo, of course, is a Pentecostal bishop, but he doesn't like dress like that when he's preaching, does he?
No, but I've seen Idahosa's wife dress up in that regalia. I've seen even the man at House of the Rock, Adifarasi, I've seen him dress up in that outfit. Although, to be fair, she did look like Little Red Riding Hood. She didn't even look like a priest with that outfit. But anyway,
you may be right on that. It's fine. I'll concede if that's the case. But I just found it strange. But I think I still stand with the rest of my points. But it's okay. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you, Henry. Let me go to Haruna. Haruna, I want to dig deeper into this issue because, once again, you're from Borno State. Shettima in Borno, did he have a reputation for being a religiously tolerant politician? That's the first question. And then the second question is, Shettima, Ganduje, and even Kaode Fayemi today have said we should not be emphasizing religion, that we should be focusing on competence and who can win. So my question to you is, if in Borno State a Christian ticket had been presented for the governorship of Borno, would people have been happy with that? Would they have been happy to accept that it's about competence? So those are sort of my two questions to you, Haruna, in your view.
Okay, thank you. I think I'll first say I'm a Christian, you know, minority from Borno State in that sense of the word, just to give a bit of context and to, you know, what I would, how I would answer. And I think I'll just answer your first question of would a Christian ticket have been acceptable in Borno State. I mean, I would just say that Borno hasn't even got a Christian vice deputy, is it deputy governor they call them, you know, so it's usually a Muslim ticket, you know. So while Borno is predominantly Muslim, I would say, you know, the Kanuri tribe is the biggest tribe, followed by my tribe, which is Baburo Bora tribe, and then, you know, but when it's time for the elections, what happens is they would usually the governor would be a Muslim. Like, I mean, fair enough, like in maybe Christian dominated state, you'd have a Christian governor, isn't it? But then when there is a balance, then, or maybe 40% of the population is say Christian, then you would have a deputy as the Christian. But we've not even had a Christian deputy governor. So I suppose it's almost impossible to think of a Christian ticket when even a Christian deputy governor is not, as things stand now, is not a possibility. Okay, so I think that would answer that question. And then just in the context of what, you know, was Shettima a religiously tolerant person? I think, to be fair to Governor Shettima, I mean, or ex-governor and now aspiring VP, I mean, I'm not a member of APC and, you know, I don't support their ticket in any way in that sense. But I think to be fair to him on a sort of maybe personal level, I would say, I mean, people may disagree or agree, you know, this is my personal opinion. I would say from my time in Borno, when he was governor, he seemed like a fair person in the sense that, you know, he was quite considerate and religiously tolerant. But you have to also understand that the way this state is skewed also means, you know, we have like a shehu, who is like the emir of the town, obviously, and so many things, you know, you would have things like what they call maybe like quota system and things, and it's usually in favor of one religion over the other, and most governors will then have to play to that tune of, you know, they have to fill in those quotas in that way, you know. So, but in terms of him being a fair person, I would say most people will agree that he's a fair person. I mean, and even the current governor himself is quite fair, but, you know, just the way the political power belongs in Borno, say, for example, is held by the Kanuri, which is a predominantly, I mean, it's a almost 99.9% Muslim tribe, you know, in this, you know, Muslim population. And so when you are given even just appointments and things, majority will come from that part of the state, which then it's Muslim in that sense. So sometimes it's difficult to measure how fair one can be. But just speaking about, you know, going back to the point of the bishop saga thing, or bishop gate, or unknown bishop, or upcoming bishop, as they call them. I don't know if recently you saw a video of a Christian video of in Borno State where some Christians dressed like the Kanuri tribe I spoke about, which is predominantly Muslim. And it caused a lot of problem in the state because the governor and the everyone had to then come up and say, well, it's causing religious tension because the Kanuris are Muslims, and so for Christians to even wear the attire it was a Christian gospel video, you know, they said that wasn't acceptable. And, you know, the governor had to come in and step in, and then the Khan and the state sort of Christians had to even come and apologize publicly to say, oh, sorry, you know, we never meant it to cause problems. So you can just see that level of, you know, well, I say, when the two previous speakers, Henry and Phoenix, have sort of said in terms of, you know, religious insensitivities and maybe that level of tolerance, you will just see that the whole thing is a mockery. And I would say, while it may not even skew the election, I think so many undecided voters who were not really sure, I would assume, you know, who are maybe religiously sensitive, especially from the Christian faith, may decide, well, if you are even going to mock us, then I think I will vote for the other party. So, yeah, thank you. So, thanks.
Thank you, Harold. I just want to ask you a follow-up question, because I note you said Governor Shettima, as governor of Borno State, was a fair man, and you think perhaps generally he's not a divisive character. I'm just checking. Did you listen to that audio conversation he was having with Governor Amosu, former Governor Amosu of Ogun State, when he was making offensive remarks about Igbos and Niger Deltans? Did you listen to it?
I've listened to it. I mean, obviously, it's the alleged tape, you know, but I suppose we were looking at it from a religious perspective. I mean, so I'm not speaking on his maybe broader sentiments in terms of, you know, that's in context of, you know, that audio message, which obviously he's never come to say it was him, or he's never denied it. I've not seen any of that, but I was speaking from the point of, you know, a religious perspective, you know. Thank you.
Okay, so the summary is that he doesn't hate Christians, but he might hate Igbos and Niger Deltans. But anyway, to our final point, which is Atiku Abubakar, after almost 7 years, about 7 years, has finally given a sit-down television interview, albeit one that was pre-recorded. And that interview in itself generated a lot of noise on social media. Phoenix, the first question is, there was an argument as to, a number of people said, why is he giving recorded interviews? Why couldn't he appear live on TV? Now, some people said it was an irrelevant issue, that if Atiku wants to give a recorded interview, so be it, that the important thing is what he said, not the manner in which the interview was granted. It was done in his house as opposed to in the studio. So my first question to you is, does it actually matter whether the interview was live or recorded or in his house as opposed to in the studio? And then the second question is, in terms of the meat of the interview, what were the key things that you found worthy of noting?
Thanks, Michael. I think for me, I mean, the question of how it was done, whether pre-recorded or not, I see merits to both sides of the argument, but for me, I wasn't really concerned, because it, at the end of the day, whether it's pre-recorded or live, it depends on who the interviewer is and how much they're willing to push you to make you uncomfortable. And I think to some extent, the Arise team did try. They touched some topics which asked the right questions. They didn't go through all the questions that one would have expected. And, I mean, would it have made a difference if that same team had been speaking to him live? I'm not so sure. So for me, it's more about who the interviewer is and how much they're willing to work on it. Beyond the idea of pre-recorded interview, so I wasn't really bothered about that. It was good enough that he was doing an interview for the first time. I'm sure there'll be more to come. He has to attend debates, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to another of those sessions that, I mean, like the one that Kadaria had and things like that. So, I mean, we have enough time to get him into a live situation and also make sure that there's a proper interviewer there that can ask the right questions. To your other point about, I mean, question which I was looking forward to, I found the interview quite interesting. I mean, again, this is someone who we haven't seen him have a proper sit-down interview in the last 4 years. I can't remember anyone, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've just not been paying attention, but I can't remember seeing Atiku, for somebody who was obviously not seeing an ambition to come back and try again. You would have expected him to stay in the public eye, be speaking on issues and things like that. But I haven't. So, I mean, for someone who hasn't done that, to see him out there. But I saw a sharp contrast to the Atiku I've seen running in other campaigns. And I kept thinking about it, and I was wondering, what's different about this guy? He was, the word that just came to me was emboldened. He had that figure of like, there was like a belief, which I hadn't seen in other campaigns. And the more I thought about it, I was like, this dude is feeling in a much stronger position, given who he's running against. Because he wasn't this, I mean, I asked people to go and check, for instance, go and take a look at when Kadaria was speaking to him and Peter Obi and some of the other conversations that he's had in the past. I think he had a sense that it would be difficult to defeat Buhari, but he had to try. But this time around, he believes that he can win and that he sees himself as the front runner. And I could see that in his mien, in the way he answered, he addressed the question. He wanted to seem magisterial. There was a lot of vim in his voice and in how he presented himself, you know, and there were even questions where he was like very quite defiant and things like that. So that was one thing that struck me, and I was like, okay, I mean, I'm the only Northerner in this race. I'm not running against Buhari, so there is some permutations in his favor, and so maybe that's what he's playing in his mind and thinking that he has a stronger chance this time around. Let's see how that goes. So the substance of the interview, there were things there that he talked about. He made some good noises, but there wasn't anything edge shaking. There was also the sense for me that, I mean, there were alignments and there were even strange things like, you know, he was also referencing Egypt and all of that. I remember seeing on social media most of these folks that try to disparage all the things that that Peter Obi tries to do, drawing parallels with other countries. But he was doing the same. I remember when he talked about security and the policing and not enough, Peter Obi has said that several times. So there seems to be convergence in some of the things that they were talking about. But where there was a clear divergence for me was there were in areas of politics, you could see that, yes, this is somebody who has played the game for a long time. So you see him more comfortable. But when it comes to the area of economy, you don't see that comfort. And it was quite stark. I mean, I remember a question that was thrown at him where he was asked, do you think Nigeria has a debt or revenue problem? He said both. Good answer. But then when pushed as to, okay, how would you solve it? He then waffled a bit and then ended up saying that he's written a paper on it, blah, blah, blah. They are key, blah, blah. Dude, you've run for presidency only 4 years ago. You are supposed to be keeping tabs on the country and to know what's going on. Surely you have an idea of what the problem is and of potential solutions. We hear other candidates talking about solutions. I mean, but he wasn't forthcoming. And so, you know, there were other bits like that that just told me that he's a man past his time. He has a good crew that will put together some document or something, but he's not grounded in these things. And so it's more about, you know, fulfilling the personal ambition to be president and to do all of that. But it was good to hear him speak, and there'll be more opportunities to do that. But it just, again, I must admit to listeners, in case there are people who are new, of course, I support Peter Obi, and so I would always look at every other candidate in that prism. I just don't see any way that there's a fair comparison between both of them. In terms of the key issues that are plaguing the country, for me, it will always be number one, the economy. We're in very, very bad situation. There's rampant poverty, unemployment. The economy isn't moving forward. We've talked about the debt crisis. You need somebody who's going to come in and fix that. There was nothing in that interview that told me that he was intent on doing that, or he has the capability to do it better than the people that he's running against. Again, I've said it on the show before. I would put, if it was a straight fight between Atiku and Tinubu, definitely there's no doubt in my mind that I would choose an Atiku ahead of a Tinubu every day of the week and twice on Sundays. But in an instance where there is a Peter Obi in the race, there's just no comparison.
Thank you, Phoenix. Henry, the first question I'll ask you is similar to the question I asked Phoenix, which was, in your view, was there any controversy about the fact that the interview was a pre-recorded one held in his house, as opposed to it being held in the studio. And then the second question, which is slightly different, is when you compare his performance to Peter Obi or Bola Tinubu's performance on TV, who do you think has been the most impressive? Setting aside, obviously, I know you're an Obi supporter, but setting aside that view, objectively, who do you think has performed better so far? Henry.
Okay, thanks. On the issue of live pre-recorded interview or live interview, for me, I didn't want to make too much of hassle about it. I didn't think that was the most important issue about the interview, especially considering the fact that I expect that there will be live presidential debates, you know, in the election season proper. So at that point, I would like to see a live debate where he's going to be with the other major candidates in the race, where there will be an opportunity for people to, for each of the candidates to take down the ideas of other candidates, and then it can be a more robust discussion. So I'd rather wait until then. I was fine with having a pre-recorded interview, but my grouse was more concerning the inadequate follow-up or some of the questions that he was asked. For example, during the course of the interview, he said something to the effect that about 90% of Northerners are not, don't have a social media presence. There were two possible questions that could have been asked from that. Number one, I would have loved to know how he came about those stats and what he thinks it means about the state of development in Northern Nigeria. And number two, I would have asked him why he then thought it necessary to go on social media to disavow the tweets that he deleted about the murder, condemning the murder of Deborah Samuel, given that was a very, it went all over the news, was viral on the internet. Everybody knew about it. And it was many people, including myself, backed off supporting him over that specific issue. I thought he would have been asked about it, and I was rather disappointed that he wasn't. So it was the lack of follow-up that I found more objectionable than the fact that it was a pre-recorded interview. Sorry, what was your second question?
I said, when you compare this performance to the performance of Bola Tinubu or Peter Obi, I mean, in terms of on TV and the answers to questions, who has been the most impressive so far?
Okay. So Atiku, it depends on how you look at it. Atiku is a well-spoken person. He's obviously, he's exposed, he's literate, he understands certain issues. So given the wide range of the interview, he did give some good answers to some of the questions that were asked, some answers that I would be in agreement with. And he's obviously superior to Tinubu, I can say that for sure. And in some sense, he did give certain answers that I found a bit more to the point than even Peter Obi in certain respects. But the problem now is, in the upcoming election, there's an issue of trust. For example, who do we trust among the candidates to deliver what they say they're going to deliver? The strategy from the Atiku perspective appears to be twofold. One, on the one hand, he wants to present himself to the South as a liberal, open-minded reformer, someone who will enact economic policies that will take Nigeria to the next level, someone who will get Nigeria working again, someone who will implement the right set of policies. And so in interviews like this, he's going to say the right things and say the kind of things that people like me would agree with. On the other hand, he is willing to pander to extremist elements in the North for political gain. And the issue of Deborah Samuel made that very clear. And that's why some of us do not trust him, and why some of us have decided we are not going to support his campaign. At the time where he thought it necessary to delete a tweet condemning extremism because certain individuals said they were not going to support him anymore, and then go on Facebook to issue a rebuttal in a regional language rather than in English, for me, it revealed his true colors. So it's a matter of trust. Who do you trust? I don't trust him. There are many people who no longer trust him and so decided not to support him as a result. And we are looking for a candidate who we can trust, who will be like, he's almost in a sense like, Peter Obi is almost like an anti-establishment candidate at this point, even though he has a he's a politician with a track record of being a politician. But at a point, it is like many Nigerians who are fed up of the political establishment are backing this campaign, and they want to see someone who doesn't represent the major or traditional power structures in this country rise to the presidency. That's where I think the election is heading at this point. That is, those are the factors that I think are driving Peter Obi's support, and why, despite Atiku giving certain answers that I may be in agreement with, that many progressive or forward-looking Nigerians may be in agreement with, the issue of trust is really what may define this election.
Thank you, Henry. Let me go to Haruna. Haruna, one of the things Atiku said was that many of his supporters or many of these northern supporters are not on social media and that generated a lot of annoyance on Twitter, because they were saying he seems to be boasting about the fact that the north doesn't have as much internet penetration as the rest of the country. And then secondly, he has broadly speaking talked about getting rid of the Naira dollar or the black market versus the official market rate. And many people have celebrated that, saying it will help to create more currency stability. So my question to you is, first of all, were you offended, or do you think Northerners should be offended that Atiku is suggesting that many of his northern base are not on Twitter? Were you offended by that comment, Haruna?
Okay, no, thank you. I suppose we need to look at it from the perspective of when he brought up that, you know, figure and why he brought it up. I think it was in response to the question of, Peter Obi and Southeast and, you know, getting the votes off him. And he mentioned something about Osun State, you know, how it panned out, that how many votes did the Labour Party get. And I think what he was trying to allude to, you know, which was that about 90% of the Northern or his Northern base would not be on social media. I didn't find it offensive. And to an extent, what he says, you know, if we are, makes sense, in that quite a good proportion of those Northerners that would be voting are not those in the cities that would have access to, say, Twitter, and Facebook too, you know, as their sort of tool of everyday communication. No, these are people that have radios and, you know, they know all the FMs and, you know, MW1 radio stations to get, you know. So to an extent, I would say I wasn't offended by that in any way whatsoever. And I understood the perspective from which he was coming from, you know, in that those core voters and the majority or a good proportion will not be people you'll find on social media. So that's my response to that.
Thank you, Haruna. And now to the second question, which is, if we are to fully float the Naira, i.e. there will no more be any black market rate, everybody buys Naira or buys dollars or pounds at the more or less black market rate or the floating rate, do you think that will be a popular policy, or do you think a number of vested interests will be offended that they can't round trip anymore, as they say in banking?
Well, I suppose at this point, I must also say I'm not the, you know, 100% one of the, I'm not someone who is 100% into economics and policy and banking from that perspective. But I suppose what he was saying seemed to make a lot of sense, in that, you know, people, issues around the Naira, you know, how it's been run in terms of the black market and things. you know, he said all that is not going to happen again, and there'll be a convergence of the exchange rates. It seems to make sense, you know. And I'll just say, generally speaking, from the interview, I do not belong to or support any political party as of now, but I was somewhat impressed by, you know, Atiku in the interview, be it was pre-recorded, which takes away some of the, you know, maybe the expectations from what you'll get from a live interview, but he was quite calm and it felt reassuring. And I was a bit surprised because I didn't think he was that, sound in terms of almost all round. Obviously, all politicians have their weaknesses, you know, be it Tinubu or be or himself, even from interviews, they would have their weak points and their strengths. But overall, I would say I was impressed by him. And if I was a neutral voter from what I'd seen him portray, I'll be tempted to say, oh, this man seems really reassuring and like the person that can do the job, because there was that reassurance. There was so much confidence. And I don't know, maybe he bamboozled the interviewers because they stopped asking the follow-up questions. And I thought, oh, well, is it that he's answered so cleverly or is it just the charisma he's portrayed? But I would say I was, you know, impressed by his interview. You know, that's me. Thank you.
Thank you, Haruna. Perhaps that's one of the, I think that's one of the reasons why people were criticizing the format of the interview, because I think in my experience, when you're being interviewed at home in your own space, you tend to have more control over the interview as opposed to if you're being in a studio in the space of the interviewer. But I want to ask you a final question, which is slightly related, but not wholly related. Shettima and Atiku are basically on the ticket to battle for the votes of the North, in particular the Northwest and the Northeast. In your opinion, who do you think is going to win the North? Do you think the Northeast and Northwest will fall behind the Shettima Tinubu ticket, or do you think they're going to swing towards Atiku?
I think that's a very good question. I suppose one of the things in the interview, you know, was Atiku made a reference. He said the two Northwest states that perhaps would go to the APC would be Borno and Yobe, where it's predominantly, you know, Kanuri dominated in that sense. But then when you look at the other Northwest states, it's going to likely be, you know, an Atiku would probably get more votes, obviously, apart from, you know, maybe Kano, where Ganduje's people are quite strong. But that notwithstanding, I think Atiku is quite popular in the North, you know, and don't forget he's also from Adamawa State, so he will get quite a good proportion of the votes. And I suppose also Northern Christians, I would say, also view Atiku as a liberal and more tolerant person that a lot of the Northern Christians would rather vote for in that sense of, you know, he's liberal. They just see him as, well, someone who is neutral, who is more tolerant. And for me, I think that would swing it for him, because then places like Plateau, Taraba, you know, he would get quite a good proportion of those states. So I think Atiku will have more of the votes from the North. That's my perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Haruna, for giving your insights. I'm sure time will tell who is right.
But, Michael, before we go, there was something towards the end that I also found interesting, because there was this discussion, and of course, he always comes back to the allegations of corruption against him, and he answered very confidently to say he hasn't been convicted, blah, blah, blah. But then there was a question that Tudu Abiola asked him about his business interests, and he talked about having started his business as a public official, as a junior officer. On his first day, he found out that transportation across the border was very lucrative, so he went to get a hire purchase agreement to buy 5 vehicles, blah, 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 blah. And of course, he pushed back saying, look, there's no law saying that a public official cannot engage in business. While that may be true, and of course it may be a loophole in the government, but there's a difference between having a farm as a public official and then running a business that is in the space that you are supposed to have oversight on. I mean, you're a customs official and you are running a business that ferries people and, of course, ostensibly goods as well across the border. So that was interesting for me that he said that. And I hope that in subsequent conversations, there will be some further, I mean, look into that, because I remember that there have been a lot of conversations, especially from PDP people, who were raising the issue of Peter Obi having invested Anambra State funds in Interfact, a company that his family also had investment in, and made a loud hue and cry about it. And I'm like, this issue of conflict of interest seems to be bubbling up, and I hope that people keep the same energy and we look more into this across all the candidates and hold them all to very high standards.
Cool. Thank you, Phoenix. No, that's interesting, because I also remember from reading Atiku's book that he also mentioned that even his business, Intel's, it was whilst he was working for Customs that Volpe set up the business and gave him shares in it. And Intel's is basically also closely related to the role of Customs. So yes, it'd be interesting to see if journalists press him on that, because my knowledge of Nigerian law is sketchy, but my parents being civil servants or retired civil servants, I 100% remember that even under the military government, you were not allowed to do any business apart from farming. But hopefully somebody will press him further on those issues. But our time is up. So I must first of all thank you, Phoenix. Thank you, Haruna. Thank you, Henry, for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. I must thank our listeners for being loyal and always giving us helpful feedback. Once again, we apologize for the intermittent podcasting. It's because I've been traveling across America for the past week and a half. I'm currently in New York City. Yes. But hopefully, same time next week, we'll all be here. So I wish you all a happy, a fantastic 7 days.
Thanks, Michael. And thanks, Henry and Haruna, for joining us this week. Really appreciate you guys being here. And thanks to our listeners. Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.